Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is Brenda Knight, who is the founding editor of Viva Editions, the author of Women of the Beat Generation, and now most recently the author of The Grateful Table, a collection of blessings, prayers, and graces for the daily meal. Love letters are really for anybody at any time for any reason at all. And Brenda, I'm going to turn to you right away because I want you to talk about you and also to talk about your philosophy of gratitude, because I'm seeing that every one of these is, it has the same exact components as love letters, which are letters of gratitude. So talk a little bit about the Women of the Beat Generation, you and how you grew up. And
yes, thank you for having me, Janet. And I grew up in West Virginia, which I sort of talk about for the first time in any of my books in the introduction to The Grateful Table. And I came from humble circumstances, for which I am so grateful because I think it keeps me grounded for life. And I just read and read and read as a kid. I mean, I was out in the sticks and there was nothing else to do, really. And I do know that my mom is an avid letter writer and still writes letters, physical letters.
Because when she was young, that was the only way to communicate.
Exactly, and she still does it. She has various styles of letters, and we joke that she writes the best poison pen in the world, but she also writes me lovely, like, just what's going on letters, and, you know, those are love letters from my mom.
And you have them all.
I do, absolutely, archiving them. And so, you know, there was nothing else to do, like, up the holler, literally, like, a mile away from any other farm or people. And so I just read avidly, I mean, probably, you know, at least 2 books a week and even got up to 3 books a week. And I was a voracious reader, you know, everything from the classics to the local literature of Appalachia, which I was, you know, amazed that there even was any local.
Oh, yes.
Local.
Okay. Tell us about that. What is the local literature? And you had a library near you. Somewhat, so you could get those books?
Oh, yes, and I was there all the time. Yes, I was in the Point Pleasant West Virginia Library all the time, friends with them. And so one of the great writers from where I was his name was Jesse Stewart. And he, I think, was originally from, like, you know, his family was originally from Scotland. And, you know, they regarded the mountains and hills of Kentucky and West Virginia to be just like Scotland. And so they felt, you know, a kinship to the days of old. And so he recorded it. There were also people that wrote about, like, going way up in the into the mountains and up the roads and where there
were. You know, this sounds like the same kind of thing that's reflected in the poetry of their music, which is stunning.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
So the lyrics even.
Right. Storytellers. Yeah. I mean, they're storytellers. So there was a, you know, basically it was a mystery of the people back there. I mean, even still, you know, there's people that live in places where there's no road and there's only a path and they're not survivalists or anything. That's just how they've lived since they came to, you know, since they came, their families came like in the 1700s. So there's lots of folklore. There's an astounding amount of folklore about my town, Point Pleasant, West Virginia, specifically.
Can you just mention a couple of things?
It is, it's uncredited. It was actually the place where the first battle of the Revolutionary War took place, but it's uncredited. I like to joke and say that Lexington, Massachusetts had better publicists.
Yes.
But really the reason it wasn't included in the history books was because the colonials hired Indian tribes to fight with them sort of as mercenaries. And, you know, the history books didn't want that reflected. And, you know, that didn't seem legit enough.
Now, what was the value of this isolation, though, in preserving
independence? They're very independent people.
And cultural habits not being watered down and...
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit that Fox News, I think, has not done my homeland any favors.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. You know, we're all subject to whatever we listen to every single day. And so I've seen how my, you know, homeland has changed.
But that's this era.
Right.
Up until now.
Yeah. Yes.
So talk about
up until Fox News, very independent. Yeah. Hopefully they will regain that.
Okay. Talk talk about your grandparents a little bit, because I gathered from what I read in your book in the beginning of it that you were really, you had chores. You were part of a working farm, and you talk about the oddness, really, of butchering becoming, having become such a trendy thing. Talk about...
I can hardly believe it.
What were your chores?
Well, at first, like, when, even before I could, was going to school, I gathered the eggs, and so I really loved... you know, I loved the hens and going in there and gathering the eggs that were still warm. And even to the point where I raised my own chicks and had a pet rooster, if you can imagine. And then, you know, I weeding and picking vegetables and things like that.
Now, was that for family or community use, or did you sell that?
That was for family use, yes. And so I have a green thumb. My mom declared that I had a green thumb when I was a little kid. In fact, like the women on my mom's side of the family, like they're gardeners. And so I have a garden. I'm a real gardener. That's really important to me. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I kept with me for life. I didn't really like taking care of, like, cattle. I had my own pony named Sparkle that I rode around. And Sparkle was beautiful. I have pictures of me as, like, even, like, as a, like, a toddler, like, astride my pony, Sparkle. My sister, Martha, she's older than me. She really loved, like, taking care. She took the... taking care of the cattle, like, very seriously, and she raised prized animals, like, would take them to the state fair, and they would get blue ribbons, you know. There's, like, I remember, like, thinking it was all a bit much or something, because she would even, like, shampoo them with, like, you know, conditioner, like, I mean, I was like, good Lord, like, that seems a little fussy to me. So I wasn't so much with the livestock, but the chickens and the garden and the vegetables. And I even landscaped the family yard. I got so into gardening that as a kid, like, I studied, like, you know, Japanese gardens and Asian gardens, and I put in a little Japanese garden in our front yard.
So you weren't really very isolated. I mean, you had your eye on a lot of very worldly.
I think by reading,
sophisticated.
Janet, I think it was honestly reading, and, you know. But of course, I was a curious kid. And once, you know, I especially got into J.R.R. Tolkien and The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, I think probably when I was like in sixth and seventh grade. And my poor mom, I mean, I now realize she should be a saint, because I would say, I want to read everything there is about Tolkien. I need to read his biographies. And in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, I mean, sure, they had The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, but they didn't have, like, anything more. But we would, the librarian would tell us, like, go into the card catalog and cross-reference and look up books in print. And she was able to tell us there's, like, five more books about his life. And, but we had to drive, like, 200 to 300 miles to, like, find those books at, like, bigger bookstores in, like, bigger cities.
May I ask what year that was?
That was probably in, like, 1971 and 1972.
And so the internet has certainly changed all of this. Nobody has to even leave the bedroom to
find
this.
Exactly. But also, like, in our explorations, I mean, as long as we were going to Columbus, Ohio, or Pittsburgh, or one of the bigger towns, like, you know, we would go shopping and looking around. And so I remember, like, on one of the trips to Pittsburgh, I think I decided I wanted a hanging wicker chair, and I brought that back, and it was really hard to, like, figure out how to hang it. And then, I don't know, my mom, like, really, she really indulged me, and I didn't realize it at the time. I think only, you know, in the last, like, 10, 15 years have I realized that my mom allowed me to pursue my passions to the point where she drove me and spent money, which she probably really didn't have, like, for all these books and records and albums. And, you know, I got so into The Lord of the Rings that I wanted an elven cloak. And we bought a cape. I mean, it probably cost, like, $60 or something, which is a lot,
like,
of money,
really?
Back then.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a lot of money if you don't have money budgeted for that sort
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly.
So at what point, then, in your childhood, did you start to realize that you were going to make your life elsewhere in some other sphere?
I think it was really in college, because I always had to work, but I wanted to work. So I worked at a nursery, which I loved,
oh, sure,
that, working at
sure.
the nursery. And then I worked at like a department store as a clerk, which was very good in terms of getting to customer service and getting to meet people and handle people and deal with strangers and be nice and, you know, learn my manners and how to deal with problem
that, solving. By the way, that learning your manners is wonderful because there's something in here about manners.
Oh, yes.
Do you want to say what it is?
Oh, you can feel free.
Well, I'm going to look for it, but you'll get to it.
Okay, yes. So I this was probably when I was 17. I graduated early, and so I started college at 17.
And where was that?
That was Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, which is about 50 miles up the river. And that was scary to be so far away and live on my own, and I didn't know anybody and, you know, felt really shy. So I had a job, went to school, and then had my job in the evening as a clerk at a department
store. Well, as a shy person, how did you start to make friends?
At the department store, and of course, like, in classes.
Oh, good.
But, let's see, I'm trying to remember where I was going with the department store. I had a... Well, for one thing, like, they sold books, and so, like, I was able to get, they gave me free copies of any book I wanted, and I know what it was. I was talking about when I realized I was going to need to go somewhere else. I started figuring out that the economy there wasn't that healthy, and I didn't think, even know if the Rust Belt, I don't think the Rust Belt terminology had come, but the Steel Belt... And was starting to rust.
Yes.
And so I was seeing that the economy just wasn't as strong as other places. You know, I was just, you know, I was also reading newspapers and the New York Times and all that. And I thought, I'm going to have to get out of here if I want to have a good job. So I knew that in college. And I was originally going to move to Boston. And then when I was talking to some friends that had moved there from college, they said, oh, our heating bill's like $200 a month. And I thought, I can't afford that. So I'm going to move to somewhere where we don't need heat.
Oh.
And that's why I'm here in San Francisco.
Oh. Okay, so talk about you and the Beat Generation, the women of the Beat Generation, because I know you're too young to have been here then.
Right. Maybe in a past life, Janet.
Could be. But what was it about that spoke to you?
Well, amongst my, you know, voracious readings, like Up the Holler as a kid, I discovered the Beats as a teenager, which many young people do, especially young guys. And I really liked Kerouac and his passion that was so clear on the page, and the others like William Burroughs. And so I just read.
So it was the people who drew you in.
It was
more
the
than
people.
The next abstract step of what they stood for. What,
well, yeah. I also knew that Jack Kerouac had traveled a lot in West Virginia. And on the road, there's a very rhapsodic section called Railroad Earth, and it's about West Virginia. It's called October Railroad Earth, and it has like a whole section that's very beautiful. And I saw that he, you know, was there, obviously had spent time there, and also knew that of the singular beauty of West Virginia. So he sort of got my loyalty then. And
I
so
see, okay.
In the same way that I was a completist on J.R.R. Tolkien, I wanted to be a completist and like read all of the Beats and all Kerouac. And of course that led me to the women of the Beat Generation that had been like sort of left out. And
so talk about that book for a minute, because I know you had an evening recently at City Lights Bookstore to honor them.
Yes, that was wonderful. It was the first time 85-year-old Ruth Weiss, who was the innovator of that jazz poetry, reading poetry to jazz, she invented that in 1939. That was the first time she had read at City Lights Bookstore. So it was a historic evening, and I felt so honored that they were honored. And I was taking a college class in grad school in San Francisco State.
In
medieval studies, believe
okay.
it or not. I'm still not quite sure what I was thinking there, although I can recognize a crusade when I see it. We had one in the previous, we had one going in the previous administration.
And we've got a variety of them going right now.
Right, exactly. Wow. So I was taking, for fun, an elective, the Modern American Literature course, and it was the Beats. It was just Kerouac, Ginsberg, Burroughs. I raised my hand and I said, what about the women? And was told there were none. I said,
I know some.
And, but my feathers were ruffled, and I decided I had a mission, and I decided I was going to prove that there were. And so I found 40. I've actually found five
40,
more.
That's a high number up for
right. none. I found like five more in the last 3 years, women that were really obscure, but like people have brought them to me. And
it is amazing who gets left out of the telling of
I
a
know.
Story.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like Point Pleasant, West Virginia, being the first place where the Battle of the Revolution
I was just going to say, yes, when you
exactly.
said that Massachusetts had better publicity.
That's exactly uh-huh. the case. Kerouac and Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg mm-hmm. had better publicity, too, and it was Allen Ginsberg himself who worked in advertising. Mm-hmm. That was his first job. He worked in Manhattan.
So he knew how to...
advertising. Uh-huh. He absolutely knew how to pitch.
Well, you know, when you think of that, I mean, in all fields, you see it in our great musicians.
Mm-hmm.
There are musicians who are as great, and they do not have the public eye.
Right. I think the new movie by the Coen brothers, and I think it's coming out Christmas time. It's about the musician whose name I can't remember, but he
See,
was,
isn't that a point right there?
He was really the one that Bob Dylan sort of stole things from.
Oh, okay.
And, but Bob Dylan became the,
yes.
the more famous one.
That is a whole interesting issue that we should mm-hmm. actually save for another time.
Exactly.
Because I want to get back to you. And
yeah.
you said something so lovely. You said something about your parents and teaching you your manners.
Mm-hmm.
So critical. And I've always felt that teaching your children good manners is doing such a favor for them
mm-hmm.
because it's making them welcome in the hearts and homes of others.
Absolutely.
What did that mean to you growing up, good man? Because, okay, here on page 158 of your book, The Grateful Table, is good manners. If the only prayer you say in your whole life is thank you, that would suffice, by Meister Eckhart. Talk
Love
about
him.
Thank you.
I think that nowadays the young people and the parents really need to be reminded of the importance of etiquette and showing good manners. I mean, it's not just courtesy. It's
the opposite of a selfie.
Exactly. It's treating people how you would like to be treated. And if you have that grounding of good manners and you've practiced it so it's instinctual, it will help you in any situation.
Now, what does that say to you? I mean, when I see good manners, I see people making others feel graceful.
Yes, that's a lovely way to put it. I mean, when I rolled into San Francisco from West Virginia in 1985, I literally was wearing a blue gingham dress. I was an absolute hayseed. My accent was even more noted than it is now. But it was much more pronounced when I just came out in the 80s. And I was, you know, very unsophisticated. San Francisco seemed like it was, you know, just, I don't know, Valhalla, you know, the city of the gods or something. And everyone was so stylish and cool and mannered, which is different from manners.
Mm-hmm.
But I did I lived as I had been trained, you know, be nice to people, be kind, be a good person, you know, always give the seat in the bus to the elder or
mm-hmm,
anyone
mm-hmm.
or women with babies or just like be a good in the world, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped me, not so much like in initially making friends and everything, but it certainly helped me when I got a job because, I came here with $500 in my pocket, which as you know, Jan, it's going to last you a day and a half. And I thought that would get me for a month.
Mm-hmm.
That's how naive I was. So I realized I had to get a job. I went into a temp agency and I got a job at Morgan Stanley Brokerage, if you can imagine. And I had like, you know, a couple of like polyester dresses. Anyway, I went in early. I minded my manners. I was nice. I did whatever I was asked with a
smile.
Well,
and you're smart and you're capable, and somebody saw through the blue and white gingham to that.
Yes.
So.
But what was really interesting, though, was that I was naturally good on the phone. Like, so they, you know, I did all kinds of things mm-hmm. to assist the brokers, filing, typing, whatever was needed. And, you know, this is like 4 and 5 in the morning too, and I had to go in and, I talked a lot. I would be answering the phone a lot and it was New Yorkers calling. And a funny thing is that like those New Yorkers loved my funny little accent.
Mm-hmm.
They loved that I was so polite and quaint.
Right. And by the way, that approaching the world with just indelibly good manners,
mm-hmm.
even if you're shy, And even if you're, you know, a stranger in town, you know who you are.
Yes.
Isn't that strengthening?
Well, at first I felt insecure, you know, because again, like I was in my, you know, hayseed dress and with my funny accent that people commented on. But then after a couple of weeks at Morgan Stanley and these rough, tough sounding male brokers, you know, would call in and ask for me because they knew I would get them their answer, help them, call them back, get whatever, do the thing, and that I would be, and that they enjoyed talking to me. Yes. And so after about my third week of being in San Francisco, I realized that my my upbringing and my accent was my superpower.
Oh, good. Okay. Sometimes it's our differences that are our greatest strength.
Absolutely.
So, now, talk for a minute about how you came to put this book together. I thought it was going to be somehow a catalog of blessings and prayers, but it seems to be more a catalog of encouragements.
That's a nice way to put it.
You know, it's the water of life. Many a man curses the rain that falls upon his head and knows not that it brings abundance to drive away the hunger. It's not exactly
a grace.
I mean, you could say it is a grace. You could say any of these things is a grace, but it's occurring to me that even the point of graces and blessings is to pause for a minute and be aware.
Yes.
Is that what you...
Mindfulness, I guess is what they call it nowadays. Okay. Absolutely. I think if in the hurly-burly of our days, which, you know, we talked about when we met here at the station, you know, people are just wildly busy. And if there's only one time in
narcissistic.
The day, yes. About it.
Oh, yeah, my goodness.
Definitely.
Yes, that's a big trouble.
The busy bragging. there's a whole thing about that. So in any case, if there's only one time a day where you get centered and express your gratitude and share that with whomever is at the table, whether it's your family and your children, your extended family, or whether it's a dinner party or even strangers at a table, graces and sharing gratitude turns any group of strangers into a family.
Gratitude is really the cornerstone of civilization.
I would agree with you.
And I heard something recently that so struck me, and it is the most important thing in life is to remember to keep the most important thing in life, the most important thing in life.
Well said, Janet.
And I just thought that was wonderful how often we lose track. This book of yours is so lovely and, you know, interesting to read. Fields of Barley, The Soul's True Worth. I just tell me or say out loud here where people can find this. They can find it on Amazon, of course.
Barnes & Noble, the corner bookstore, and Amazon, obviously.
And it's a beautiful looking little book. It looked lovely on your table.
Yes, absolutely. And it's definitely and admittedly and purposefully eclectic. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it to be like your grandmother's book of blessings, but she'll like it too.
Oh, good. Yes. It says the prime virtue, the essence of all beautiful art, all great art is gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what isn't really if it's done well? I've been thinking about that.
You greet the world with all good things can happen. And if you're a positivist like that, good things are going to happen.
And you talked about coming to this after your life was filled with your own trials. And whose isn't?
Right.
I mean, most people.
Oh, everybody has problems, but how you handle them is the
key. I mean, you talk about problems with losing people you love.
Yes.
And I know that happened with you.
That certainly did.
And at some point, maybe these awarenesses help you realize that you're still here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can also use this book as claromancy or bibliomancy, where, do you know what that is?
No, I'm waiting.
Your readers will. Well, you know, I'm from the Bible Belt, and back there, one of the things people do if they just want like a little blessing for the day is to open up their big old Bible and then just at random point to something.
Uh-huh.
So let's see what we did using that.
What do you got?
It's February 24th, the food on the table. He left it for us. this, something that should be for people's happiness. They will be strong in body from it. He left us all this food. He scattered this all over the earth. Now we will give one thanks that he left us all this food to live on this earth. This is the way it should be in our minds. And that sort of sounds like it might be somebody talking about God, mm-hmm. right? Well, that's a Seneca Indian Thanksgiving prayer.
Oh, my goodness.
They're not thinking of a god, a white man that lives in the clouds.
Yes, well, I don't know how we got to that anyway as a concept.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So that's a Seneca Indian Thanksgiving uh-huh. prayer. And the Senecas were one of the major tribes where mm-hmm. I come mm-hmm. from. So there's one of the things I really enjoyed doing was putting in, like, blessings from all over the world. You know, there's Hebrew, Christian, mm-hmm. There's even like Sufism mm-hmm. and all kinds of, there's something from every wisdom tradition and walk of the world. And then,
so I just got one. I just okay. opened up and I got surprised by joy. I admit to being at times suddenly and without the slightest warning, exceedingly happy.
Lovely.
That is lovely and really critical because I think people tend to be more verbal and more aware when they're ticked off.
True.
And when something goes wrong, that tends to take a lot of our energy. And giving the same yeah. energy to when you're just elated, think how that can spiff up your day.
Right, but if you are sour for some reason, say mm-hmm. you got a ticket or somebody mm-hmm. dinged your bumper or something like that, you can turn that around in 1 minute with one of the practices that's actually included. I think it's on page 51 of mm-hmm. the Grateful Table. It's to stop and think about three things you're grateful for and just immediately, what's immediately mm-hmm. comes to mind without thinking. So I'll ask you, Janet.
Three things I'm grateful
yes.
for.
Uh-huh.
The friendships I have in life,
mm.
my family, and my ability and good fortune to be able to do what I want.
Absolutely. I love that. I guess if I were to ask myself the question,
please.
I would say grateful to my mother mm-hmm. who, you know, I mentioned her in the beginning that I really learned gratitude, you know, from her. Grateful for my boyfriend, Richard Chin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually learning Cantonese from mm-hmm. him, which is really fun. I feel like growing a new area of my brain.
Yes.
And I'm grateful for my work. I feel like I get to do really meaningful work.
Uh-huh.
And through that, like, get to bring authors and writers that have major contributions
uh-huh.
to help others. And so I'm very grateful for that.
Oh, that is nice to hear. You know, you did it more fully than I did it. And if we're going to allow, actually, why not, for the people we're grateful for.
Yes.
My goodness, you know, my children, my granddaughter, my husband, and again, my friends, and doing this.
Right.
You know, evoking love letters from people, which is the same thing you're doing, which is evoking gratitude.
Yeah.
And having people write it down. And on that note, because we are about love letters here, you talk about your mother a lot. Have you written love letters to her to say thank you for things?
I have.
Nice.
I have.
Okay.
And I'm sort of ramping it up, too, because I don't know whether maybe it's just my maturation, you
mm-hmm.
know, that I'm you know, crossed over 50 and I have a wee bit more wisdom. And so I say things like, you know, love you forever, eternally.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
What about the specifics? Like, thank you so much for spending that $60 that you may not have had on the Cape for me to see me through my Tolkien years.
I have said, I have said to her, like, oh goodness, I only just now realized that,
oh, you had to, oh, good.
That you really went out of your way for me,
well,
like,
okay,
literally so, hundreds of miles.
You know, these kind of letters to parents, and my own experience in working with people who are writing love letters from the parent, is almost always one of two things. Either, I didn't know you knew that about me, or I didn't know you would remember that.
Oh.
And that gift of having remembered.
Right.
Just like in your book, the gift of being aware, being mm-hmm. conscious of somebody outside yourself.
You know, all people want is to be validated.
Yes, and to feel attractive on every level and to know they did the right thing.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Isn't that what life is about?
At the time, you know, a mom of a, you know, teenage or an adolescent girl, good God, there's no more, you know, you would never think you would be appreciated, you know, that's just like
right.
doing, that's just being a good person.
Yes.
And so I've come to appreciate her more like week by week. And you know, maybe this is also human that we sort of start reflecting like back on, you know, childhood
yes.
and things like that.
And the
yeah.
power you have. the power you have when you take up that pen and write that love letter is just hard to believe. I mean, I think people sometimes don't realize what power they have when you decide to do the validating.
Right.
And you take that upper hand.
Yes.
It's quite a gift.
Yes, it is.
Oh,
so I'm so glad you're on your crusade for letters. I think it's very important. I did want to ask you a question.
Please.
My boyfriend was telling me, you know, obviously this is the anniversary of JFK's assassination, and he said that he watched many documentaries about it, but there was one called Letters to Jackie. Did you hear about that?
Yes, hundreds of them after he died.
Right.
Yes, the
right.
condolence letters to her. You know, that having something in handwriting, because every letter she got, as isolated as she had to be in that horrible, horrible moment.
Uh-huh.
And when you're facing the death of someone you love, you are isolated.
Right.
You just have to be. It's a private, tormented moment. Every letter she got to touch something that felt the hand of someone else's touch.
Right. And it was a love letter to her, really.
Definitely.
Even if it was like, I'm so sorry.
I mean, she had physical contact.
But I had no idea that it was so international. I just didn't know.
Yeah.
But she had, not only was it letters from the Americans, but it was from the world over.
And doesn't that always make the news when something intimate is found?
Right.
Because it's important.
Yes.
It's so important.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for doing this. This is just so nice to hear from you. And this book is just gorgeous. I so enjoyed reading it. Thank you. And I just want to say that if you think you need a special occasion to write a love letter, please remember that writing a love letter is a special occasion. And if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to say grace or to give a blessing, you don't. Every one of life's moments is worth a blessing. And there are so many helpful ones in this. It just feels good to read them and say them out loud. So thank you.
You're
Brenda
so welcome.
Brenda Knight from The Grateful Table. This is Janet Gallen saying goodbye for now, and I'll talk to you later.